CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 59, with Dr. Steve Silverstein, becoming involved in ophthalmic clinical trials. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast, and today I have a very special guest, my friend, Dr. Steve Silverstein. Steve's an amazing ophthalmologist who's heavily involved in, of course, building his own private practice, like all of us, but also in the clinical trials. And I've learned from him from many meetings, and I'm really excited to welcome him to our podcast. So welcome, Steve.
Thank you so much, Uday. I'm so honored to be here with you.
Now tell us a little bit about your background, your path to ophthalmology. How did you choose ophthalmology? What were your practice situations after you finished your training? How'd you get here?
It's funny. I had never even been to an eye doctor my whole life until the end of my first year of medical school, when I was nailed in the eye by a racquetball and had a total eight ball hyphema.
And wow.
Quickly met my first ophthalmologist. And during his care for me, he seemed so happy. And I asked him, are you really enjoying ophthalmology as a profession? And he loved it. And he really encouraged me to take a rotation in it. And I'm looking around the office at the toys and the lasers and thinking, boy, I would really love to explore that. I was also very interested in OBGYN and actually did an out-of-state rotation in that and interviewed in several programs. But when I did a rotation in ophthalmology, I was just hooked. I just loved it. And interestingly, I'll never forget this story as far as inspiration goes. I was a third year medical student doing this rotation in ophthalmology with J.J. Rousey, who was head of cornea at D. McGee in Oklahoma at the time.
Sure.
And I came in and coming into the clinic one day was a fifth year senior general surgery resident from Texas. And as he's telling Dr. Rousey his story, he is literally crying. And he says, I have this condition called keratoconus, which I'd never heard of before. And he said, I struggled to keep my vision with contact lenses, but that's not possible anymore. And my attending staff says that if I don't get this fixed, they're not going to be able to graduate me. And all I've ever wanted to do was be a general surgeon. And Dr. Rousey took him by the hand and he said, son, you're not only going to have this fixed, but you're going to be a brilliant general surgeon. And I thought, oh my God, this guy is just an inspiration to me. So that's what inspired me to go into cornea, as well as my rotation in ophthalmology. So got to do a wonderful residency in Boston at Tufts, and then my cornea fellowship at the Kellogg Eye Center at the University of Michigan, which I loved so very much. And I've been here in Kansas City now for 33 years in practice, and
wow. And I'm
just getting warmed up.
I love it. So right out of your training, you just set up solo practice?
I went in with a gentleman. We were together for 10 years before he retired. During that time, we had also joined another practice, the Hunkler Eye Centers with John Hunkler, Dan Dury, and others, that we were all building one large practice in Kansas City. And at our biggest, we were 30 doctors, 3 surgery centers, 9 locations. It was really something. It was a great practice, but the practice management company we were affiliated with broke us apart. It was really a very difficult chapter, but taught me and all of us so much about the business of medicine. And although it was a tortuous time, I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. Those lessons learned were very powerful and brought that back to my practice that I bought from the gentleman who ultimately retired. And he and I are to this day the best of friends. I operated on him, put in premium lenses and did femto, and I operated on his wife and his kids. And we're just truly as close can be.
Now you were saying the previous practice management company, so basically like the first kind of iteration of private equity way back when?
Exactly, long ago. It was called Novamed. On paper, it sounded good, but in practice, it was a disaster, just a disaster. So for all the partners, it was really a sad time in the chapter of ophthalmology. The biggest contrast to private equity is that back then, You've got shares of stock with the hope that someday it would take off. Whereas with private equity, you get most of your cash up front. So that was a serious lesson learned by all of us. But these are the lessons that make you stronger. So I have no regrets. And I'm still very, very good friends with all of my former partners in that practice, most of whom are still practicing in Kansas City. Some have retired, some have moved on. But it gave me the opportunity to create Silverstein Eye Centers. And from there, just grew and grew, different locations, different doctors, this built the surgery center, learned some things over the years. For example, put in a hearing center many years ago, thinking that if people are here to trust you with your eyes, wouldn't they like to trust you with your ears too, their ears? And that was true, they did. But once patients learned that insurance doesn't pay for hearing aids, they really didn't follow through. So it was a great experiment, glad we did that, but not successful after a number of years. So there's a lot of learning, there's a lot [S2] Right. [S1] Of back and forth, there's a lot of circuitous turns and serpentining in your practice. I'm sure you've been through that too, to say the least.
Right.
But as it turns out, I could not be happier. I'm in a very strong place. I have an incredible staff. That's what makes or breaks you, your staff. It's just an amazing opportunity to work both in the clinic and in the surgery center with just a really, really great group of people. So grateful.
What were your most important take-home lessons from your involvement with that practice management group? What did you take away from that that you can share with our listeners so we can learn through your experience?
Absolutely. I think for starters, anybody who's trying to tell you that they're going to manage your practice for you and let you do what you do, namely the clinical, the medical and surgical part, they really don't have the experience to make that happen. Mm-hmm. They may be good in marketing, they may be good in IT, but as far as managing a medical practice, it was a disaster. A lot of staff left. There were a lot of tears shed by really loyal, longtime staff. They just came in and were only interested in the numbers. That's not a healthy way to run a practice. You have to keep patient interest and needs as a priority, and equal to that, the needs of your staff, and make sure that they're well protected. So that was the most important learning experience. They just drained the corporation dry. It was a really painful chapter, all with the promise that someday your ship will come in and that stock will pay off, which it never did. The practice management sector collapsed when Wall Street realized that it was a facade, that their growth was only based on acquisition, not on same-store growth. And it was the collapse of the entire PPMC sector across the country. So that group of people retooled and disguised themselves as practice management companies that have hospitals, surgery centers, ASCs, and they're still alive and well. And I still have surgery partners as my partner in the surgery center. I own half, they own half. And that's been a good working relationship. They're good people. But to do it all over again, never would have sold the practice and would have had 100% ownership and control of the surgery center. So now I had to buy my practice back. This is back 2002. So it's been a long time. But again, we've never been stronger, never been happier, and a lot of important lessons learned. Learned about the power of IT in the practice. Learned how to handle marketing well. Really strengthened OD networking relationships. Learned how to really be able to recreate and reconstruct any business from just a study of the spreadsheets and the P&Ls. So that getting a grip on learning how to manage and learn from your general ledger as far as your overhead, where's the money going, how are we spending it, how are we negotiating contracts, nobody comes out of training with this information, but
right.
learned all of that during these years the hard way. So I really strongly recommend that you have an advisor that you really trust, somebody who's also a CPA and a medical practice advisor who can really help guide you through the years and help you understand the changes in healthcare policy and in taxation, et cetera, to help you and your corporation put your best foot forward. My former partner told me very wisely to surround myself with satellite help, you know, IT, legal, consulting that are superior in their area to help guide me. And it certainly has paid off.
Well, I like your one philosophy of you have to put the patients first and your office team second. And it's not all about the bottom line. It's not all, the most important thing that we do, obviously, is treat patients. And for that, we need ourselves and our team.
Absolutely. Ownership in a surgery center has been wonderful. If you live in a state that allows you to have ownership or to build a surgery center, and you have a volume of at least 700 cases a year, that's kind of the litmus of when to pull that cord and start the journey into your own surgery center or partnering with people at the surgery center, preferably a group of all doctors.
Right. Where do you think we're going with the in-office suites for surgery? Because that's something different. So instead of going to a surgery center, a lot of physicians now, ophthalmologists, are doing their own in-office surgical suites.
I think that even they would tell you it's better if you could have ownership in a surgery center. But if that's less likely, or if you don't have a critical mass of patients consistently through the year to build a surgery center, then it's a certainly viable option. You don't want to take any shortcuts. You don't want to, create an environment that's less sterile, less safe than an OR. But you're not going to have as much of the expense and regulation and oversight. But you're also not going to have the support of the insurance companies either. So it really is a delicate dance. If you do a significant amount of clear lens exchange or corneal-based refractive surgery, or other liquidity-based procedures where insurance isn't required, at least in those cases, then it can be, certainly viable. But if you can, I would really encourage you to reach for the building of a surgery center or joining someone else who has a surgery center and using your collective cases to help dilute overhead while being accretive in the profitability. If there's one thing that the government has not done, is done anything to harm the reimbursement in surgery centers. And in fact, usually it increases the reimbursement of surgery centers, because at the end of the day, it's still a lot less expensive for the payers than to take cases to a hospital-based facility.
Right. For our young ophthalmologists who may not realize that, it costs, let's say, your insurance, your payer, your insurance company, far more to pay for that surgery in a hospital, like a multiple, as opposed to a surgery center, which again has a very small fraction of that fee. So they'd rather you move to a surgery center.
Exactly. I mean, in a hospital, everything that's opened is a charge item. Every WEC, every Q-tip, every 4x4, every viscoelastic, everything that's opened has a barcode and is billed for. And the services in the facility are billed by the minute. So you can see very quickly how expensive cataract surgery or any other surgery can be. Whereas in a surgery center, there is a part A and a part B to insurance coverage. The part A goes to paying the surgeon, and the surgeon is going to get whatever he or she is going to earn, the same in a hospital as in a surgery center. But the surgery center will get a set fee for a given surgical CPT code or that is designated for corneal transplant, cataract surgery, pterygium excision, retinal detachment, et cetera.
For our young ophthalmologists who are still in a residency, we got a lot of residents who listen to our podcast. 66984. That's your friend right there. You can look that up. 66984. And sometimes 66982. But you didn't know this.
You know, and I have to turn this conversation away from me for a minute. I'm sure your listeners and watchers are aware of this, but you have been such an idol for so many of us for so many years, Uday, taking on things early in your career and teaching us so much. I remember, for example, when the crystal lens came out and listening to you talk, you and I were walking to an ad board and you were teaching me right then and there about making sure that you hydrate the roof of your incisional wounds, especially with the crystal lens, which I do on every case now, thousands and thousands of cases later, not to mention your lectures and
thank you.
So I honestly love learning from you, and you have been such an incredible inspiration to me and to so many others.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, we all learn together. We're all, you know, ophthalmology is a tight-knit group of people. I mean, if you look at any med school class in the U.S., what, 1% of the graduating seniors go into ophthalmology? It's a tiny field.
True.
And so we all know each other. We all learn together. But yes, a very important lesson. Now, let me ask you about your practice is amazing. And I love your advice about being involved in the surgery center. I've been a partner in my surgery center here in Beverly Hills for, gosh, coming on 20 years. It's been a smart move for sure. But how else do you grow your practice? Now, do you have efforts in terms of marketing, or it's the co-management, it's word of mouth? It's, how are you growing your volume? Because sometimes for a young ophthalmologist, your biggest challenge is not the technical aspect of surgery. It's getting the patient in the door.
100%. That's absolutely true. First of all, the key to success is work ethic. And you have to ask yourself, do you have what it takes to really put in the time and effort? The whole conversation of work-life balance, yes, it's important. But like anything worth doing, it's going to be hard at first. You've got to build a practice the way you build a young family. Unfortunately, those things are happening simultaneously. So you're pulled away from your spouse or significant other. You're pulled away from your children, and that's painful. But you remind yourself that you're doing this for them more than any other reason. And that if we're fortunate enough and we have the good fortune of building the practice and maintaining our health and our skill set, that shift will come in. Work-life balance is going to be more of the work part and the balance later. You can't necessarily go into this thinking that you're just going to punch in and punch out, even if you're an employee doctor. To build a practice, you've got to do it the old-fashioned way. Roll up your sleeves, be giving those lectures in the nursing homes, give lectures to the medical staff, be on call for the ERs of your area hospital so they can call you as needed. And that will help grow practice, that will help grow patient base and reputation amongst the doctors, seeing inpatient consults. One inpatient consult that makes the patient and the doctor, referring doctor, happy will mean many, many years of ongoing consultation and referrals later. So the number one source of patient growth is word of mouth referrals from other patients. Second to that is primary care. So even though I know there's a lot of focus on OD networking, which is number three, primary care can be a huge, huge piece of your early growth. And that just continues to perpetuate over the years, because when they find somebody they like, they tend to stick with them. Whereas optometrists tend to you know, sprinkle some referrals here and there to try to share that love. Primary care doctors are really loyal. Yes, working up your OD network and building that is imperative. You want to be available to them for their emergencies, their questions, their calls. You want to give OD CME lectures at your expense when you can. We try to do that at least three times a year, renting out a restaurant or a big private room and bringing it and getting the lectures that we give approved by COPE, which gives them not only a good meal, but also their CME, which they're needing. Mm-hmm. So Number one, word of mouth from patients. Number two, referrals from primary care. Number three, OD networking. But don't negate the importance of marketing. You just got to be smart with your marketing dollars. Marketing can come in a lot of different forms. Radio is usually the most biggest bang for the dollar. You know, zip code mailings usually get thrown right into the trash. Published magazines and newspapers, very mediocre response. But also try to befriend and get to know and care for some of the more famous personalities in your area, and then ask them to be a spokesperson for your practice. And over the years, I know you've done that too, Day. And, you know, I've operated on the head coach of the Kansas City Chiefs and other Kansas City Chiefs players and Kansas City Royals, and the Hall of Famer Frank White is a patient of mine, and taking care of his family. And, you know, just one thing leads to another. So marketing is a necessary evil in our practice. It doesn't have to be that you don't have to spend as many dollars later in your career as you do initially. Another area that I really love, and in fact, our friends and colleagues, Cindy Matosian and Penny Asbell, and I gave a lecture at Telling It Like It Is last week in Tampa on building a clinical research department in your practice.
That right.
Can be not only really fun and really intellectually stimulating, but it also could be lucrative. Once you get rolling and once you are known as an excellent clinical site, the people who monitor these clinical trials or the sponsors who pay for these clinical trials will tend to go back to you again and again because they know that they're going to get accurate, ethical, timely data with good patient enrollment from you. So clinical trials has been a very important part of my practice and growth. I've now been the PI or medical monitor in well over 130 clinical trials at this
point. Wow, a lot.
So, and I love it. We have a whole research team in the practice doing nothing but phase two, three, and four clinical trials for pharma, for diagnostic instruments, and for surgery.
Yeah, that's an important thing to understand all that too, but you have to know your population. For me, one of the challenges for clinical trial is that sometimes Beverly Hills patients are not interested in being in any kind of trial. So you really have to know your market. You know, I don't know your patient population.
That's true. But even Beverly Hills folk get glaucoma. And
No, for sure. For sure. The hard part for those, obviously, when you do enroll, you have to be able to enroll patients in your study.
Right.
You need to have access to those patients who are amenable to being in a study and have the disease that you're studying. But also, you need to have great follow-up.
That's true. That's so true. And you're absolutely right, Uday. Your demographic is going to make that successful or unsuccessful. So you're 100% right. But, you know, a premium IOL trial, for example, would probably fit in very nicely in your demographic.
Right.
In any demographic for that matter, but might be something they're inclined to buy into, saying this is the next generation of what you could get today, or maybe you can be 2-3 years ahead of the curve and get it before anybody else. So, you know, just something to talk about with them.
Yeah, fantastic advice there. Now, on the OD co-management side, so in Los Angeles here, I don't really do any OD co-management because to me, I found that it's just like a bidding war. I mean, who's going to pay them more to come in? So how, for a young ophthalmologist who wants to get started on this, who's considering this, how do they get involved in OD co-management? Just hit the streets, meet the ODs in person? What do you do?
Yes, you meet these people in person. You go to their offices. I'm not one of those people to say, bring a box of cookies. You're not trying to buy their loyalty.
Right.
When I first came into town, I sent a letter to every MD and every OD in Kansas City and said, I'll be starting practice. I'm fellowship trained in cornea. To the MD colleagues, it was a separate letter, and I said, I'm not trying to in any way invade your patient demographic. I would just be so grateful if you would consider me for your cornea referrals. to the ODs. I said, I'm available to you anytime you want for whatever type of consult. We want to make this as smooth and easy for you as possible, and I'll follow up with a visit. And I did. And I came and I went to every office, and I brought them stacks of cards to leave for them, even the Costco optometrists and the Sam's and the Walmarts, etc., as well as the privates. You are grateful for any referral, whether it's that 5 o'clock corneal ulcer or the pressure of 60, or if it's a surgical consult, whatever. You're just grateful for all of it. My father, who's now passed away, but was a very, very successful plastic surgeon in Oklahoma City. When I got into medical school, he said, I want to teach you about the 3 A's of success. And I've never forgotten this.
Okay, let's learn.
The 3 A's of success are availability, affability, and ability. So in other words, always be available to your patients, to primary care doctors, to your ODs. When they need you, they need you. So be available to them. Doesn't mean they own you. And if you're away or whatever, yes, you have a right to be, you know, legitimately away. But if your OD calls you and they need you and they need to get a patient over to you, even if you're home, you go in and see them. Affability speaks for itself. You know, people want a warm and compassionate and caring doctor. And then ability also. But ironically, availability and affability even trump ability as far as growth, as far as reputation.
Absolutely. I mean, when I first started practice, I did exactly what you're saying. Anytime a referring doctor called with a patient, I'll see the patient today. Just send them over. I'll see them today. Done. And I ended up doing, to be more available even to my patients, I did a night clinic Tuesdays and Thursdays till 8 p.m.
Wow.
I did a Saturday morning clinic as well. I just did whatever it takes to just like, yeah, I will be there. And there were times where I just volunteered. I'll take the hospital call for ophthalmology. I'll take the entire month. I'll do it.
And for ophthalmology practices, I would call all my competing practices in the area around Christmas and say, look, I'm Jewish. I know how important Christmas is to be with your family. Let me take coverage. I'm going to take it for my practice anyway. Let me take call for your whole practice. And anybody who comes in emergently, I'll make an appointment. We'll book an appointment for them to see you back after Christmas. And I'll send you a letter about what they came in for, et cetera. That just builds goodwill amongst even your competition, so that you're known as one of the good colleagues, not competition can be friendly competition or it can be evil. There's no need for that. There's plenty to go around.
Right. I look at it like you do. I'm not cutthroat. I don't believe in that kind of crazy competition. I compete mostly with myself, just trying to do better and better. And anyone in the community who does cataract refractive surgery, even next door to me, you're just a colleague. You're not competition. We compete against ourselves.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. So be available and always be kind. And patients are so, so surprised that we got them in that day. And they're especially surprised when we're nice. And it's like, well, shouldn't it always be that way? If not in your doctor's office, where in the world do you possibly expect that to be?
Right.
So it's not just about the golden rule. It's about setting the bar and being the bar.
Right. Oh, and the golden rule, like you said, super important. We learned that in kindergarten. I give every patient the same high level of care and treatment that I'd want for my own eyes. That's what you're getting. You don't have to worry. Am I going to do this step and that step? I will give you exactly what I'd want for my own eyes.
100%. And that's what I tell my patients too. Another that I would only treat you or recommend this if this is what I would do in my own eyes. And it's true. You know, like, for example, years ago, I learned and was certified to do holmium laser for hyperopia and by the company called Sunrise Technologies. And I did all the work. I did all the wet labs and I was certified, but I didn't like the data at all. Same with the intracorneal inlay for presbyopia. And, you know, I got certified on it, but I just didn't like the data. I mean, they're all excited about the possibility of 70% success, and that was not working for me. So I wouldn't do it on me. I never offered it for a single patient. But that's not to say I'm not an early adopter for legitimate technology. Right. And that's where clinical trials comes in, because I get a sneak peek on, behind the curtain years yeah. before something hits the market or never hits the market.
Yeah, that's a neat thing for sure, to have access to these newer technologies or agents prior to them being widely available. You get early hands-on experience, that's for sure. You know, in some of the procedures, I was talking to someone yesterday. Someone asked about changing your eye color, which, you know, in Los Angeles, very big about cosmetic things here. Now, we've all seen in the past the absolute train wreck, which are these implantable silicone device that sat on top of the iris, and those patients ended up with bad glaucoma and cataracts and corneal decompensation. Those were absolute train wrecks. But now, apparently, even here in the U.S., there are surgeons doing, quote, laser eye color change. Which they're doing is essentially using a femtosecond laser to make a corneal donut, intrastromal, corneal kind of shelf, if you will, putting in tattoo pigment dye there, and then putting the flap back down. So it's
I know, I would never consider that. And taking that one step further, there is a laser that's been used and trialed in other countries around the world, especially Asian countries like China and Japan. There's a laser that will literally change your iris color.
Depigment it, basically.
Depigment it, right. And especially Asians who all have the same eye color but want to look distinct, want to look unique, want to look different. It can take that dark irides, their dark irides, and turn them into, you know, light gray or even a little bluish, et cetera. And I, you know, I've met with that company, but again, nothing I would recommend for my patients, nothing I would invest right. in. But you're right. People are desperate to look for individuality and cosmesis, that's for sure.
Wow, especially in like my neck of the woods, especially in the Los Angeles, Hollywood, Beverly Hills area, it's a really common thing. But no, I agree with you. If I wouldn't do it to my own eyes, I'm not going to do it to your eyes. I'm not going to offer it to you. And so, yeah, I will stick with these brown ones, even though it may be interesting to have a different color. I'm pretty happy as is.
Well, you know, if someone needs to play around with that, then, you know, colored contact lenses are probably their safest bet.
For sure. I think that's a great point there. But yeah, it's ultimately, you know, getting back to what you said before, you got to treat from the heart and put your patients first. And their well-being is obviously always more important than just like the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Really got to stick with that concept now. So what do you, of the things you can tell us about, I don't want you to violate any confidentiality agreements here, but other things that you have studied in your clinical trials, what do you think is coming for us down the road? What's coming on in terms of surgical or pharmacologic agents?
There's going to be some really interesting premium lenses, one from India, one from Israel, and others that don't use either a multifocal diffractive platform nor any type of adjustments like the LAL, but rather some type of flex where there will be movement in a liquid form to behave like our own natural crystalline lenses, to expand and contract and expand and contract for zooming in and zooming out. Or lens implants that where the optic, where you put in a base into the capsular bag, and you can click in or click out a lens implant if you need to refine it or change it. Of course, there are some really interesting things way down the road, like a lens implant, and this is not just whiteboard. This, you know, there's already work done with this technology, but lens implant that has little nanomotors and circuitry that will allow the lens to mechanically zoom in and zoom out with a battery that can be a 50-year battery that can be charged standing next to a charger or with a little flat mat under your pillow at night, and also enough memory and processing to literally, you know, flash data before your eyes or watch a movie before your eyes.
Wow, this sounds so futuristic. This sounds amazing.
I know, it's really incredible. There's another technology that's been played with off and on for years, whereby you take a buccal mucosal scraping, you grow a gelatinous goop in a culture that will ultimately become your new lens. You go into the eye with a micro trephine and just do a 1 millimeter trephination in the anterior capsule, inject little metal beads into the bulk of the crystalline lens. Underneath the patient's head are rotating magnets that you control with a joystick, getting them spinning faster, slower, in all three axes, left, right, up, down, and turn the cataract to mush, then sucking it out through a very small IA type a machine, and then injecting that goop back into the bag and putting a little plug into the anterior capsule hole so that it really does behave like a gelatinous soft lens that can expand and contract with ciliary muscle action. I mean, it's just, it's one of the things I went into ophthalmology for. It's just, I am so blown away and fascinated by the technology. I will forever be its student, forever. You know, I'm never bored. I'm always humbled to get to be in ophthalmology. Just what, you know, when we're at our meetings, and just having the conversations that we have with each other,
right,
just to be around such incredible minds. And yet we are also work hard, play hard kind of people. You know, just love, you know, the didactic and intellectual conversations, and love the, you know, the partying aspect too, you know, going out for cocktails, et cetera. It's just such a stimulating group of people. I can't imagine how fortunate I am to be in ophthalmology. It's just so humbling.
But you bring a great point that in our field, the only constant is change. So you got to keep evolving. You got to keep running. Like you said, you're a lifelong student.
Absolutely.
For our young doctors, if you're finishing your training now, congratulations, you chose the best field of medicine possible. But your learning is just beginning. And in 10 years from now, you will do surgery completely differently than the way you were taught in your training.
Oh, man. 90% of what I do now is all since training. 90%.
Right. Isn't it right?
There was no such thing as excimer laser, femtosecond laser. The first time I ever saw a video of an excimer laser was in the 80s, where they were using the excimer laser to make radiokeratotomy incisions. But it didn't work at all because the incisions were so precise and no collateral thermal damage on either side that they closed, sealed up quickly, and the effect was lost until someone like Steve Troquel and the gentleman in Germany, Theo Seiler, taught us that no, we don't want to make radial cuts. We want to make a concavity or excavation or change the shape of the cornea that way. Just one intuitive step after another. Another thing I'll share with young doctors in practice or residents and fellows is that when I was a fellow, I was at a real crossroads because it was so much I loved about academia. And yet I just didn't want to go that route. I wanted to be the captain of my own ship. I wanted to make my own mistakes and enjoy the fruits of my own successes. But yet I still loved all so many elements of academics. So I decided to roll the dice and create a career that incorporated both. So I have my private practice, which consumes the vast majority of my time. I'm also on faculty at the medical school. I used to go in and teach resident clinic once a week and teach them in surgery once a week and give them didactic lectures and grand rounds and part of their board review. But now they come to my practice and spend a month with me doing block rotations with me. And then, you know, the research department scratches that itch. And, you know, I teach second year residents in ocular trauma during that section of their classroom work. because of the research, it's allowed me to become a KOL, a key opinion leader in our field, and allows me to have wonderful relationships with industry, just like you do, Uday. And those relationships and that research also allows me to write and to publish and to be on editorial boards. So all the things I would have done in academia, I also have incorporated into the private practice. And I love that. I love that balance. That for me is work-life balance.
Well, it's important to point here that you can actually evolve your practice. So the way you're practicing now is great, and you may decide in the future, let me incorporate something different, maybe a little teaching, maybe some more research stuff, maybe becoming a key opinion leader, maybe more traveling or podium time. But you can teach in many ways. You don't have to be just one of the above.
And yet, just like Uday, for those of you watching this, you know, there's so much about the rest of life that I loved. Raised three wonderful children. One went to the dark side. He's a dentist.
They're smarter than we are.
Yes. One's in IT. And then my daughter is now a board certified pediatrician. So I'm very proud of all of them. My dream was always to live on a lake. And so I live on a beautiful lake. And I ultimately, years into my practice, 15 years into my practice, built my dream home. I'm in surgery on Tuesday and Thursday mornings, but on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, there's a group of us that get together anywhere from 5:50 to 6 a.m., and we pick each other up at each other's docks by boat, and we just ski. We ski the slalom course, we ski the lake, and then go in, take a shower, and go to clinic. I mean, who gets to do that? You feel like a kid in camp.
And that's living the life.
And I've gotten to serve the community in many, many ways. It's very modestly speaking, you know, philanthropy means a great deal to me. I don't care whether I get the credit or the accolades for it, but the practice has, as far as the philanthropy, and I've served on numerous philanthropic boards and done a lot of charity work. That too has been exceedingly rewarding. I was also, for 20 years, I was a state-elected city councilman, mayor pro tem, and police commissioner for 18 of those years.
Wow!
Just a lot of fun things. You know, I served on the board of directors of a bank for 19 years. Things just so out of the realm of medicine or healthcare, but just all that go into a diversified, well-rounded life, you know, with, you know, work hard, play hard.
It sounds like an incredible adventure.
You know, it comes down to two things: work ethic and time management. If you are good, if you're a good disciplinarian of time, you can stuff a lot of things into a day that is above and beyond just normal clinic and surgery.
Right. I think I've certainly got the strong work ethic. I can work like incredibly hard, but the time management, I'm still learning. I'm not the best on time management. Sometimes I go to one extreme or the other.
What are you doing for fun these days?
Oh, my favorite thing now is just, you know, I love to ride my mountain bike and I love to lift weights. So I'm happy to say I can bench press the same weight that I did when I was a medical student.
Wow.
Yeah. So it took me, since COVID, to get back to that. It took about 3 years to get back to that level.
That's amazing.
Yes. But I'll tell you one thing. After age 50, you don't recover the same way you do as when you're like in your early 20s. Early 20s, the next day you feel great.
I know. After water skiing, I mean, it takes me until the beginning of July to work out all of the pain that the first part of the summer season instills, using muscles that you don't ever use during the rest of the year. And it takes longer and longer each year to get that back. But, you know, if you're driven, if you're motivated, it's happy pain.
Well, I think we're living our best lives here, because obviously the main kind of driving factor in our lives is ophthalmology, all different aspects of it, as we've discussed, but also just incorporating the other fun parts of our life. Whether for me, I travel a lot internationally to give lectures. I'll be heading out in a few days to go to Singapore and then India. And I did a dozen countries last year. So I'm really, really enjoying that now. But it's also the fun of raising a family and now being a proud empty nester. And it's been a wild ride. So that's why I'm so encouraging to these young ophthalmologists. There's so much to learn from these podcasts. from people's experiences, there's just so much you can draw from. Like today, our podcast, I think this is the really take-home lesson for a young person, where that those your dad's three A's of success. That's so important. Availability, affability, and ability. Those are all so, so important. The importance of being involved in a surgery center. Being your own boss at times. The only challenge there is I'm my own boss, but sometimes my boss is too tough.
One thing I always tell the second year medical students who are, you know, really struggling because they're exhausted and they're sleep deprived and they have so far ahead of them. And I say, I already congratulate you. I already view you as an equal, as a colleague. You're doing the right thing. What your path ahead is going to provide for you and your family is unsurpassed by any other field. And then I turned the attention to the women and I said, I know that you particularly have a tough balancing act between your career and being a mate and being a mother and having some time for yourself. You have to include time for your relationship, and you have to give yourself some time too. And sometimes the kids are going to vie for more time than the other categories, and they're supposed to. But you can squeeze that time in there for you time and for spouse or significant other time in such a way that you really can find balance. I promise that it's something that you can do successfully and do all three well.
No, for sure. And then also keeping perspective that it's all a zero-sum game. Life's a zero-sum game. So all the great pluses and amazing things in your life, I promise you, will be balanced out by some negatives and some big challenges. But it kind of gave me hope that always like, okay, if I'm having a tough time in life in whatever aspect of my life, let me compartmentalize, let me get through this, because if it's tough now, that just means the sine wave is going to go to the positive side shortly. Just kind of hang in there.
Exactly. Some of the things I did to try to speed up that journey is I would record some of my surgeries and I brought them to peers in my community that I really looked up to, that I really respected. Mm-hmm. You know, like John Hunkler, for example, when he was practicing. And I said, now, John, be kind about it, but I want to show you some of my surgery and I really would appreciate your constructive criticism. In every little minute detail. And I did the same with our business consultant and met with him offline outside of our business meetings and said, teach me line item by line item about the spreadsheets. Help me understand the ones and zeros like the matrix about how how a practice runs, what we look at to make sure that trends are going in the right direction or how we correct course if they're not. How to recognize these things without too much time slipping by and before we realize that we're not doing something correctly. How do we learn from something we were doing? Building another revenue stream, for example, without bringing in more staff. How do you do that? What diagnostics does your practice lack that could bring in more revenue but also be beneficial to the patient and ethically appropriate? So, you know, learning about the business of medicine from your consultants, learning to be a better doctor and surgeon from your mentors. These are all things that help shape me and make me a much, much better doctor than trying to just journey alone.
For sure. I think that's a really important point. And on these podcasts, I'm hoping to get some of these business ideas across to our young listeners, in fact, all of our ophthalmology listeners. But also now on the video side, you can see we recently had a cataract coach video where a surgeon ended up dropping a nucleus. And I watched the video and I wasn't quite sure what exactly happened or when did the bag break. So I posted the video and elicited comments from all our viewers. Dozens and dozens of comments later, you can now piece it together. To have 50 surgeons leave comments and have 5,000 surgeons watch that video, that was just a really helpful way to kind of crowdsource an answer. So it's so amazing how we can incorporate new technology to become a better surgeon.
Speaking of which, as I was watching your surgery in awe, at telling it like it is a couple of weekends ago, I was very, very honored to see that, and you may not even know that you were using them, but the Capsorexis forceps you were using in some of the videos, I invented. For Storz and B&L, I invented their mix instrument kit with the chopper rotator, as well as the mix Capsorexis forceps, which I use in every case, but those ones that have the hash marks on them that you were using to show the size of the capsule in Devo. Yeah. So I was like, wow. And Dr. Osher was using them too in some of his videos. I'm like, jeepers. That was,
you know, listen, big influence. Like I said, we all learned together. It's an amazing time. Well, I look forward to seeing you again very shortly at an upcoming meeting, hopefully the ASCRS right around the corner.
Definitely.
And I want to thank you again for doing this podcast. Such important topics we covered today. I'll have a summary of this posted down below for our young viewers, especially. There's so many great pearls in this that make you a more successful ophthalmologist.
I can't thank you enough, Uday. This has been such an honor to talk with you, and I hope that there's been some lessons learned, some things to from a crotchety old doctor, but still very much in my ophthalmic youth.
Right. I hope we both have continued and much longer careers.
Thank you. So grateful to you. Thank you, my dear friend.
Thank you. And I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new podcast every single week, always coming out on a Sunday. We're on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, YouTube, anywhere you find your podcast, you can find the Cataract Coach podcast. Also, remember to check out our website, cataractcoach.com. New video posted every single day. Well past 2,000 videos now. We also have a free PDF book about how to learn cataract surgery, a free 25-part curriculum series for the young doctors to really learn all the tricks and secrets for surgery. And we will catch you next time.